The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. Sponsored by Raiden Solicitors. Award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to The Parents Show on Mix 92.6. I'm Elisa Carcar, bringing you honest conversations to support and inspire you as we navigate this wild parenting journey together. Today, I'm joined by Passan and Damien, two dads and the voices behind Dads to Wins. They're parents, partners, and passionate advocates for modern fatherhood. Today, they're sharing their unique journey into parenthood as LGBTQ plus parents through surrogacy. Hello, Passan and Damien. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for having us
here.
You are very, very welcome. So to start us off, can you tell our listeners a bit about yourselves, who you are, what you do, where you're based from, and who's in your family at home?
Yeah, so I'm Damien. I am a northern boy, born and bred, moved down from Yorkshire. So when I sort of moved into the working world, and I sort of met Passan at the tail end of my university studies. We sort of moved in together and formed a relationship, moved together. In London, and pretty soon on, we realised that we were looking for a family.
Yeah. So I'm Passan. I'm originally from Sri Lanka. I came here for university, and then I stayed on for work. We're both teachers as well, although since we had our babies, we made the conscious decision to take a year out. So we get to spend more time with them because we've been working hard to make our family, and we thought 1 year is worth taking the time out to kind of be with them. And that year has gone by very, very quickly, or is going by very quickly. And yeah, no regrets on doing that.
Amazing. What an absolute gift to give yourselves and obviously your children too. So take us back to when you first started thinking about becoming parents. Like, what made you decide that this was something you wanted?
I think for me, always known I wanted a family even before realizing my own sexuality. Like I grew up with in a big family, and I knew I wanted my own someday, and I've I suppose worked hard to kind of get there.
And I guess I'm a little bit different in that I grew up in a quite conservative area in the north of the country, knowing I was gay, and didn't see any same-sex families around. I think subconsciously for me, it seemed like it was never, ever an option. So I never really sort of let myself think about family and what that would look like when I was young. And it was only really when I sort of got older and moved into a more liberal environment that I saw this as an option, and met Passan, who is fiercely knew what he wanted. And if he wanted it, he would have it. And I realized I also wanted children and just hadn't ever thought it might be a possibility. So when we came to that realization that we both wanted children, we worked really hard to make it happen, and looking at various avenues, different routes, exploring different journeys to parenthood, whether that be adoption, fostering, surrogacy, and it was surrogacy that we landed on pretty early on.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. So your journey to parenthood has been rather unique through surrogacy. I was listening to the interview that the Parents Show did with our sponsors on the legal side of surrogacy, and I was surprised to hear actually how few families form their families this way in the UK, but it is growing. And also they talked a bit about the kind of outdated law in the UK, and so more people going overseas. Can you explain, I guess, what surrogacy meant for you and why you chose that route and how you even began that process?
I think, as Damien mentioned, we looked at different options. Adoption, I suppose adoption and surrogacy. Although we didn't rule out adoption, I think initially, because I had the thought of my own family, so I thought, this is what I want to do. So I wanted to be biologically one of ours to begin with, at least, and maybe later on adopt. But I don't think we kind of explored that too much after we realized surrogacy. And I think we started the surrogacy journey pre-COVID. So 2019 is I think, when we started looking at that.
Mm-hmm. The surrogacy process itself took obviously a very long time. We started in 2019 pursuing, and when 2025 when our child was born. So it took several years to get to the point of pregnancy. But I suppose just going back a step, for me, adoption was something which was very much a possibility. And I think actually, initially, I thought if I was going to have a child, it would be through adoption. In my mind, naively, in my mind, there were so many children who were of babies looking to be adopted. But sort of the reality of that, it's not quite as romantic as I think people think. You know, there's lots of hurdles and barriers in the way. You know, that child will, of course, be yours and your son, your daughter, your family, but will look very different, be a very different experience to parenting a baby from birth who sort of grows up with your, I don't know, with you, with them as babies, I guess. And mm-hmm. I think you've got to really, lots of people who look into adoption, we weren't the only two. We've got lots of homosexual and heterosexual friends who have looked into adoption. And sort of they've all come to the same conclusion that we did, that it wasn't for them.
Yeah.
So it was an option, but it wasn't the right one.
Yeah, even though you can adopt from birth, I think there are some few, I suppose, but some cases where you could. But I don't think adoption is as straightforward as people think it is as well. Because one of the first questions we used to get is, especially from people, as soon as we told people, oh, we got babies, or why didn't you adopt? We can come back to that later, but it's not as easy as people think it is. And the other thing is, coming back to it now, is people would never do that to a straight couple. They wouldn't say, oh, we've had a baby, like, oh, why didn't you choose to adopt?
Mm.
I don't think there's any malice to that question. I think they just think, well, obviously you couldn't have a child naturally with yourselves. So adoption is the most straightforward option for people who haven't thought about it. But I think it's kind of making people realize that, but you wouldn't ask this from a heterosexual parenting couple. But at the same time, you can't take everything as personal attacks. You got to kind of realize for what it is as well.
I also don't think it is actually is that straightforward at all. We have a homosexual couple who are friends of ours who looked into adoption, and they met the council. They went through the channels, and they were actually told adoption isn't the right thing for you guys. You know, you should look into surrogacy. They were told that by the authorities. This is too. Yeah, very lovely, a lovely couple. Both of them teachers, so fantastic with children.
But a university,
and yeah. So I mean, I think it just shows it really isn't.
Yeah,
it's not a.
But we also know the two university lecturers who are also denied, and they're a straight couple. Like, they're both employed, very good jobs, very good incomes, but it's not for you.
So yeah. Surrogacy was the way forward for us.
Yeah, definitely. And you chose to do this overseas. What was the reason for that? Did you start trying to do it in the UK before going overseas, or how did that all happen?
Yeah, so when we first started looking to surrogacy in 2019, we were sure we were going to do it in the UK because lots of reasons. One reason, well, we joined an organization and we really liked their ethos, which was that you and your surrogate become friends.
Friendship first,
you become friends, and they will remain a part of your child's life forever in whatever way that works for you as a team, for you as the parents and the surrogate, and the surrogate's family often.
Yeah.
And we liked that idea. Finance was also a factor. In the UK can be, it will still be very expensive in the UK, or relatively expensive, but it's often a lot more abroad. The reason being, in the UK, one cannot pay for surrogacy. You can pay expenses, and expenses often mount up quite high, but is going to you ultimately usually cost less money than sort of commercial surrogacy, right, which is where someone is allowed to be paid to be a surrogate in countries like Cyprus and America and Canada, which is where surrogacy journeys take place. So we really did want the UK, and we're part of lots of various online groups trying to get to know surrogates and other IPs, other intended parents like ourselves. We would go to socials sort of every other week, every fortnight. We'd be either at an in-person social or an online social, which is where in theory you might meet a surrogate and connect. And then it's the surrogate in the UK, or at least within this organization, who chooses you, who says, I'd really like to get to know you more, and maybe we can be a team going forwards and looking to a baby journey.
Yeah, so in this organization, it was every week there would be either an online or an in-person social, And once you join, you are given an invitation to their own platform where you need to kind of keep a journal. And it's also recommended you keep posting on the Facebook group as well. So it's quite a task to kind of be very social out there. So it's things like, I've had an ice cream. It's so the surrogate kind of sees what kind of people you are. So they can be like, I like these people. I want to help these people. But to do that, you need to really put yourself out there. And which we did, because we're fairly, I wouldn't say we're introverted people, but so we were fairly outgoing. We've been to these socials. We even hosted a social online and in person, which was in the park nearby. And since 2019-20, we didn't come anywhere close to kind of meeting someone despite putting all that effort. Because at the same time, we were both teachers, we were heads of departments, which is quite taxing as well. So we did our day jobs and then we'd come and focus on this. And it's quite an emotional, taxing journey.
It just didn't work out for us. We sort of never got that tap. We never got that call. And it was actually one day at one of these socials, we were speaking to a lovely young lady who had been going to socials for about 10 years. And she was great. She was so bubbly, so out there. She told us about how she had her embryos frozen, ready to go as soon as the surrogate sort of gave her the nod. And after all of these years, she'd just never gotten the tap. And it was sort of after that social, we came back and I was just a bit down about it all. We'd invested years. And I just thought, how is she, this fantastic lady, like, what is it? Like, why are we not? Why is she not? And I just thought, if she's not, after all this time, maybe we need to explore something else. And we'd always sort of, I'd always said we really shouldn't go abroad because the cost being the main one really.
Also one of the things we wanted was we liked the ethos and we liked the idea that our children will know their roots as much as they can because I think it'll be important for them. But then I think we had to make a decision on whether we are focused on that aspect and not have a child and have the dream of the child knowing the parents, or do we actually want to have that family? So I think it was that choice.
So at that point, we started looking at other options. We spoke to someone within the surrogacy community who we knew had had children abroad and got their two Penneth. And actually, we decided to go. We actually quite soon after decided to sign up with an agency abroad, and we went with the same one that our contact had been with. We wanted somewhere that we could sort of trust, because something we were very conscious of is that there are these organizations abroad, and some of them actually are scams, or they are not too ethical. Some of them close down after a few months and have everyone's money. Some of them there is no baby. And they prey on vulnerable people, such as intended parents who desperately want a child.
And I think just the point of that is when you're in that situation where you are desperate to have a family, £1,000 here, £1,000 there, once you've saved it up, won't matter a lot comparing the whole proportion of the cost. Mm-hmm. So these organizations, individuals, groups would scam these vulnerable intended parents to, all you need is £1,000 and then we can get you signed up. And you're thinking, £1,000 is nothing compared to what I would have to pay. So yes, take my money. Please just make it happen.
And I do a runner.
Yeah.
God, that's awful, isn't it? That's really sad. Wow. So, this is 5 years, this whole process has taken you in such a journey, such an emotional tax on you guys, and having to go through different routes. Were there moments of doubt along the way? And if so, what helped keep you going?
Yeah, so whilst the first sort of 3-4 years were very slow and nothing happened, as soon as we went abroad, everything happened very quickly. We took the organization in October and got to know a little bit more about them, how they work. We had lots of questions about the process and how and the surrogate and how she's looked after and sort of what the entire journey looks like. And then we went over in December. So about a month and a half later, we were in Cyprus where we had some testing, sort of deposited the sample. And from there, everything just moved very fast. By January, we were told we had been matched with an egg donor. By February, we had embryos created and they were in the freezer ready to go. And by March, we had a surrogate and we were pregnant. And then by the following January, we had our lovely twins. So actually, from the point of going abroad, it only took, well, four months until pregnant, pretty much. And then obviously another 9 months before we had our two little tykes.
I think also just to kind of take a step back as to why the international surrogacy, we were a bit cautious. One of when we had the conversation with the organization, one of the things we wanted to make sure was no one was kind of exploited. Everyone was there willingly. Everyone was looked after, including ourselves and including the surrogate, the egg donor. And having spoken to the organization, it was very clear that they ticked all those boxes. They looked after everyone, which was then reiterated by the surrogate herself. After she gave birth, she came, we invited her over for lunch, and she mentioned that she was looked after, and with the money that she's kind of earned, she's going to go back to her own country and she was going to buy a house for her family, which she said she would not have been able to do in her own country in 4 or 5 years. So with this, she was given a lifeline for her family while she kind of helped us have our family as well. And as far as we were concerned, that reassured us, because organizations can always say, yes, yes, of course, everyone's looked after. But until you hear it from those people, we were then kind of rest assured, good, no one was exploited. Everyone is a winner here. And that was quite nice.
And after the birth, she invited us over to her apartment where she'd been sort of put up by the organization, looked after while she was pregnant. She introduced us to like the friends she'd made in the neighborhood that everyone knew her in the shop, and they saw the babies and like, oh my goodness, because she'd been telling.
Yeah, so that was quite a nice story. So what the organization does is, so once to be a surrogate in this organization, you need to apply, and they do all the health checks, and once they think this person is suitable, they will put them in their books. Then they say, look, we've got these surrogates who are willing to do a surrogacy for you. The first one actually didn't work out because they said, oh, actually, she doesn't want to do a twin pregnancy, so that person is out. But this person is willing. Would you like to consider? Yes. So they're kept in this their accommodation with other surrogates, so they have the support as well as the organization support, so they're not alone. And if they have little children, they can be accommodated as well, so they're not away from their parents. And so while she was there, she used to obviously go with her mum to the shops for her shopping. And then one time when we were taken to her apartment, she stopped by her usual grocery store and said, remember the bum? This is these guys that we were holding. And the shopkeeper was so emotional as well. And they were like, oh my God, can't believe that that's happened. And so nice to see the babies as well. So it was quite nice. So she was looked after. And because there's so many kind of stories where people are exploited, and that could be the case as well. So it's up to the parents to do as much research as they physically can to make sure that it's not happening.
Yeah,
amazing. So you chose twins.
So we have the option of transferring one or two embryos.
Okay.
And if you transfer two, by no means does that mean you'll get that twins will happen. I think they say something like, if you transfer one and they're high quality embryos, there's been lots of testing before, there's something like a 70% chance that it will take first time. If you transfer two, there's like a 90% chance that one will take, and maybe a 50% chance that both will take. So, you know, good odds for twins. And I think I'd sort of said earlier that part of the reason for not going abroad was I thought, we've only got one shot at this abroad. It's very expensive. And we wanted to have more than one baby. We wanted two babies. And I didn't think a surrogate would pick us up in the UK in the future if we'd already had a baby, especially through international surrogacy, or certainly not in the organization we were in. I think they would want to help a family who didn't have any children, or who certainly who, you know, weren't able to go abroad. So yeah, yeah, we were crossing our fingers for twins, and we got,
how wonderful. So when did you actually meet your babies for the first time, and can you describe that moment?
I think we met them 5-6 minutes after they were born. Well, Lika, we did. River was a little bit sleepy. He needed to be checked in a little bit longer, so we met him a few hours after. So we were in the room next door to where they were kind of born, where the surrogate was, and it was quite surreal because, like, they just rolled in a baby, and we're like, here you go. Here's the first one.
Bye.
Yeah, because it's not as, I suppose, nurturing as the NHS, where it's very much more like, here you go. Because it was in Cyprus. And we're like, oh, okay, what do we do now? And it was, and I think it took a moment for me at least to kind of hit, oh my God, I've just become a father.
Wonderful. And have you kind of been able to meet any other surrogate parents along the way? I know you met a lot of intended parents along the way, but have you been able to connect with other surrogate parents too?
I think having the Instagram channel has helped. And I think people we met along the way in the surrogacy journey who have been successful, I think we've kind of reconnected as well. And there were so many people who were going through the pregnancy that we were able to kind of reassure them, because of course it's quite a arduous kind of journey. So we were able to kind of reassure them, whether they were abroad or whether they were here as well. So I think we have quite a few people who we are connected through the Instagram.
Yeah,
channel.
That's amazing. I was going to ask you about the Instagram account. You know, you do have a unique story, and what made you decide to share that publicly through your Instagram account?
I think because we went through such a hard journey, we just wanted to kind of showcase it is possible. Because if you see in the Facebook groups, it's the people there are living on hope and desperation, and will this ever happen to me? I know it's happened. So we kind of wanted to reassure people, look, it takes a lot, but persevere, it is worth it. And we are here to answer any questions. There's nothing that's off the limit in terms of cost, in terms of experiences. We are open and honest on what we went through, so we can kind of reassure and help, as someone helped us to kind of pay it forward to people. And another big thing is, because obviously I'm from Sri Lanka, and in the Asian communities, it's not a thing. Homosexuality is still criminalized in Sri Lanka. So I wanted to kind of be a presence for people, and like to give people hope, like whether it's homosexual or heterosexual, like surrogacy is an option to consider. So don't give up hope, because everyone who wants a family deserves to have that family.
And for me, I look back to that, you know, that boy growing up in the north who never even questioned that family might be an option for him, for me, because there weren't role models, because it just wasn't happening, it wasn't seen, there wasn't visibility. And I still don't think there's that much of it now. So we want to be those people who are spreading that visibility and showing that a family is a family. All it needs is love. It doesn't matter what that family looks like, whether it's same-sex couple, different-sex couple, solo parent. Child just needs love. And there are routes to parenthood, lots of different routes. And this is ours, and this is the one that we can and will share. Yeah, just to sort of say, you know, go for it. You can have it. You are entitled to that, just like everyone else is.
That's so inspiring for others. And you've also spoken in terms of kind of like role modeling and being that face of alternative routes to parenthood. You've also spoken about the role of fathers needing to change, having experienced becoming fathers together, and looking at society and how the different roles play out in families. What do you mean about kind of you feel the role of fathers needs to change, and how has becoming parents yourself sort of influenced how you see modern fatherhood?
Yeah, so I mean, the first thing to say is my employer was very generous and really understanding about the fact that we need to be abroad for a while. My standard paternity leave would have been 2 weeks, and they supported me in being there for my children's birth. If they hadn't, I had two options, which would have been I would have had to have quit, which contractually I couldn't have done at that point, or well, what's the other alternative? I don't know. there isn't one. Or, and I think that's the thing for a lot of employers. The standard paternity leave is 2 weeks, and or whilst the shared parental leave has come into play in the last few years, I really don't think that's, you know, worth sort of the piece of paper it's written on, because as soon as you move on to shared parental leave, the other parent, traditionally, let's say the mother, curtails her enhanced leave a lot of the time, which means actually she isn't getting any top up from her employer, and the family is financially far worse off, which then leaves for the vast majority of families, the only viable option for the father, traditionally the father, to take 2 weeks off, and the traditional mother to be off for a longer period of time until her enhanced leave comes to an end. And it's just not good for anyone. Dad doesn't get to be at home with his family and sort of enjoy bonding in those really important first few months. Mum, whose body is recovering from 9 months of strain, is at home alone and not getting that support. And on top of that, is often then taking time out of her career and sort of losing her status with an organization. And it's just it just doesn't work for anyone. Everyone loses out because of these antiquated systems that we have in the UK. And it needs to change.
Yeah, and that could kind of lend to future education of the child's mental well-being and their ability to absorb and develop. It might have consequences there as well. I think for me, I think Damien mentioned about the financial and the physical presence. But I think for me, it's more the semantics of fatherhood. I think it stems from the fact that the traditional father has to kind of go to work, and therefore they're losing what we experienced was the bonding isn't just for 2 weeks. It takes perhaps the first 2 weeks aren't anything because the child's not going to bond straight away. So it takes months and months of it. And it makes me really sad to think people, fathers usually, are losing out on the experience we had with our children. That magical time watching them just grow and develop, that's a loss for them. And the mother needs that support because she's just gone through a huge, let's say, an operation. Like usually if there's an operation, like the doctor would say you can't work for X amount of time, but they have to from the second that they deliver to kind of look after the child. The parent, the father goes to work and they are completely by themselves, and that's not helpful for anyone. And therefore this stems into the world of marketing where everything is directed at mum. And that then pushes those fathers who are there, alienates them and think, hold on, it's not just mum. I'm also in a few groups where it's usually like, oh, to mums or hey mums. But then I know that there are fathers in that group and we're thinking, what about us? We are also here. I think it's a systemic point, or where you need to kind of include the wording to parent. There's nothing wrong with saying parents as opposed to mum or dad, because if you want the father to be involved as well, stop kind of alienating the father by just saying mum's net or mum's world. It could be parent because you want to include the father in the decisions as well. It shouldn't be the mother who is responsible for changing nappies, feeding, especially if you're not breastfeeding. There's no reason why the father can't be bottle feeding the child. I mean, we've done everything with them, so there's nothing a man, other than obviously breastfeeding, can't do to look after. And especially when to give the person who gave birth to their children a chance of respite so she could recover and kind of look after that child. But include men in this, give them, trust them, because you trusted them to have a child with them. Now trust them to bring that child up. Because most parents are like, oh no, I don't trust my husband to do this. I can't, he can't do it. He doesn't know how to do it. I know how to do it. Trust them, give them the opportunity to show them, look, well, you, this is your child as well. You need to do it as well. Like, we need to do this together. It's parenthood, not mumhood or fatherhood. It is parenthood. You have both come to this realization. You want children. You have planned this child or not planned, whatever. But you are in it together. So work together as a team. And I think the world of marketing should change in terms of parenting as opposed to mums. Because the moment they do that, even like, the supermarket adverts, that's putting more stress on the mother. Or this is the mother's responsibility. These, so it should be the mother. And the men would be like, well, it's not for me. It's mother's duty. That's the mother's role. That shouldn't be a thing anymore in this day and age. It's not a mother's role to do anything that a father can't do unless it is breastfeeding. Mm. Anything else a father can do.
Mm. It's madness, isn't it, really? Just these stereotypes are constantly reinforced. I remember with my first being shocked that there was no baby changer in the men's toilets, but there was only in the women's. So, I mean, how have you navigated these situations? Because you're faced with this as a pair constantly, being playing more those motherly and the fatherly roles, whether it's going to a baby group that's called a mum's group, or you need to change your baby's nappies, but there's no nappy changing in the men's toilets.
So I think the baby change situation has gotten better, and I don't think I've noticed where we haven't had one before.
It could also be the fact that we haven't got out as much.
That's true. Yeah,
I mean, you know, my children are older, so this was a while ago. But it is... society is set up for this. And like you say, with the paternity leave and the shared parental leave, kind of everywhere you look, society is sort of reinforcing those roles. So for dads listening who do want to be more involved from the very beginning, what encouragement would you give them?
Just like, do it, and step up, because, you know, your partner needs it really and will really value it. You don't wait to be told to change a nappy. Change a nappy, you know, from that first moment, you are an equal parent, and, you know, and that other parent, you know, will really value you doing it. Don't get into a rut where you are sort of, you know, almost like the second parent, because there is no second parent, two parents.
Yeah, and also you're not babysitting when you're looking after your children. These are your children. You are looking after your children. And for the fathers who are already doing this, like, well done, and like, continue to kind of speak up and kind of be there and be that present that you already are, and kind of talk to other parents who might not be, and encourage them to, because they are missing out on their child's lives. And it's such a beautiful, precious, rare gift to be a parent. Not everyone has the ability to be parents. It could be due to natural causes, it could be due to financial reasons. There's so many people who want to be parents, and we have been gifted with parenthood. So just be there for your children, and it'll help them as well to see good role models for the future, so that they could be as good as you are.
And one more, fight with your HR. You know, get your you know, sort out paternity leave. It's at your employer's discretion what paternity leave and maternity leave looks like. And, you know, I've got friends who have very good paternity leave, and most who have the standard 2 weeks, and it's at their discretion to make it better. And it really is better for everyone. Probably your employer as well, at the end of the day. They won't see it straight away, but, you know, their retention, employee satisfaction would be higher if parents can do their job properly as parents for that time. So, you know, before you're having your next baby, or if you're having a baby soon, you know, speak to your employer and see if they're like willing to budge on their current outdated practices, so that you can be at home more with your child in those first few weeks and months.
That's really great advice. And for parents listening who are considering alternative routes to parenthood, what's the one thing you would want them to know?
I think do your research before, especially if you're going abroad. do your research as to whether those companies exist, how they kind of look after the people involved. And even if you're looking at a surrogate here, again, there could be scams of people. So please do your research. I know you might be desperate to have the child, but kind of take a bit of time to at least know the people, know the organization, so you're not going to end up in a bad situation.
And by that research, speak to lots of people, join lots of online communities, speak to people who have different experiences. So, you know, there'll be groups out there for those who are looking into or who have adopted. Speak to those people if that's the route you're looking at. Same with fostering. If you're looking to surrogacy, join UK groups. There's quite a few of them. There's a couple of big organizations, and then there's lots of like smaller
independent groups.
Join them, see what they're about, how they work. You know, ask questions to the community, not necessarily to the management of those groups, because you won't always get true statistics, or you know, they won't necessarily mean to mislead. But you know, yeah, some organizations will talk about how they've had X number of, you know, journeys this year, but how does that actually stack up compared to the number of people in the organization, that sort of thing. You want to know. And yeah, and abroad, speak to people who have gone abroad, find out who they were with, what their experiences are, because we know, you know, from people we've spoken to, there's some out there which, you know, seem really good, really look after everyone. There's a couple that aren't, you know, very good at all. And then there's so much apparently scams. So just make sure you've spoken to real people. And we're always happy to talk. You know, that's what we're here for.
Amazing. How would people reach out to you if they wanted to ask you any questions or kind of pick your brain on this?
They could message us on the Instagram channel. We are, well, I look after it, so I always read the messages. Yeah, we're more than happy to kind of help.
Amazing. So it's Dads Twins.
Yeah, that's the word Dads, the number two, and then Wins. Dad. Excellent. Two.
Amazing. Win. That's wonderful. Passan and Damien, thank you so much for sharing your unique story and your perspective so openly with me today. I'm sure it'll give our listeners so much food for thought. I've learned a lot myself. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you so much for giving us the opportunity.
If you've just joined us, that was Passan and Damien from Dads to Wins talking about modern fatherhood, shared parenting, and their journey to becoming parents through surrogacy. I'm Elisa Karkar, and I'll be back soon bringing you more honest conversations to support and inspire you as we navigate this wild parenting journey together. Until next time, take care.
We'll take a quick break now on The Parents Show on Mix 92.6.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.
Thanks for joining us again on The Parents Show on Mix 92.6.
I'm Lydia Elcourie, and tonight I'm really, really pleased to be joined by Jodie Moore, who's an associate solicitor at Raiden Solicitors here in St. Albans. Jodie, thank you so much for joining us on The Parents Show.
Thank you so much for having me, Lydia. I'm excited to be here.
And we're really looking forward to talking to you tonight. We're going to talk about surrogacy, which I have to, in all honesty, say I didn't think was an area of law, never mind an area of family law. So I'm really fascinated. I've got loads of questions lined up for you. But before we start, can you tell our listeners about your role at Raiden Solicitors?
Yeah, so as you say, I'm an associate solicitor at the team at Raiden's. We're a specialist family firm, so I help clients generally on the breakdown of their relationships to deal with financial claims that they might have against each other and also issues pertaining to children. But I have a particular interest in surrogacy work as well.
Great. So we're going to talk to you about surrogacy in general, and I think it's a fascinating topic to speak about. I certainly have a lot to learn. What exactly, you know, in terms of the legal framework, what does surrogacy mean?
So surrogacy is essentially where a woman carries a baby and gives birth to the baby for either another couple or another individual. There are two sort of types of surrogacy. First of all, you have what's called gestational surrogacy, and that is essentially where the surrogate acts as a host. So they have no genetic link to the child, grow the baby, and that's the surrogate's role, or alternatively, traditional surrogacy. And this is where not only does the surrogate carry the child for the intended parents, but she is also providing the egg. So there is a genetic link in those circumstances.
Oh, okay, yeah, big difference between the two. And I'm sure the implications legally are greater as a result of that.
Actually, they're not. They're not at all. It's exactly the same premise. I mean, I guess you sort of have traditional surrogacy, and it's called traditional surrogacy because it's something that we could do prior to IVF being, you know, and scientific developments enabling us to do something else. But no, that, you know, in terms of the way the law deals with them, they're you know, exactly the same in terms
That's
of the process.
Really interesting. And how common is it in the UK? I have to say, I don't think I know anybody who has been a surrogate or had a child through surrogacy.
Yeah, so it's very hard to know how many children are born through surrogacy every year, as there are no absolute statistics available on the number of surrogate cases that we have. The data that we do have, however, relates to the court applications that people make to obtain what we call a parental order. And that is essentially an order that provides intended parents with, you know, the legal rights and status of parenthood for their children. From the data that we do have, we're talking, you know, really quite small figures generally across the UK. But in 2008, there were just 67 parental orders made across the whole of the UK. By 2022, that's grown to 449. So we're still talking about really small numbers, but you can see that there's a massive increase just in that period of time. And I suspect probably they will continue to increase as people look at, you know, different routes into parenthood.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, surprisingly small numbers still, actually. I don't know why I thought it would be bigger. So what is the process that needs to happen with surrogacy, and where does the law come into play with it?
Yeah, so we have a legal framework that surrounds surrogacy here in the UK. It's actually quite old, though. It dates back to the 1980s when sort of IVF first came on the scene. And as a result of that, I would say, unfortunately, the law surrounding surrogacy is more about tolerating rather than encouraging it. And this is because, you know, back in the 1980s, realistically, that, you know, there was a different public attitude towards surrogacy. There wasn't the same acceptance of it as being, you know, an acceptable form of family formation. And also we had less tolerance of the diverse range of family forms that we do have today as well. So what the current law does is it permits surrogacy in only certain circumstances and puts conditions upon people's ability to sort of enter into surrogacy arrangements. For example, the law as it currently stands prohibits commercial surrogacy. So we have what we call altruistic surrogacy here, which means it can't be done for a profit. And there are prohibitions on your ability to, you know, if you're an intended parent, you want to find a surrogate, you're not allowed to advertise for that. And if you're somebody that wants to act as a surrogate, you're not allowed to advertise the fact that you're, you know, willing to act as a surrogate. There are also restrictions on people's ability to sort of broker arrangements unless with a very specific conditions are met on a non-profit basis. So ultimately, you know, if you're somebody that's looking at starting a surrogacy journey, looking at finding a surrogate in the UK, the options that you have available to you are either to sort of, you know, do something informally. You've got personal connections, somebody that's willing to give that gift to you through social media, or to utilise the service of a small number of surrogacy agencies which operate in the UK to help match parents and surrogates and to help them through that journey. The sort of third alternative is to go abroad and have an international surrogacy and take advantage of perhaps the more developed and streamlined legal process of other countries. So, for example, you know, some states in the US, in particular, somewhere like California, have a, you know, much more streamlined process than we do over here.
And could we say that the law is maybe a little bit outdated?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, a very fair comment. There has been a recent report, actually, that's been prepared suggesting recommendations as to how the law can be updated.
So it's so interesting what you said about the framing of how surrogacy is possible. It's very restricted and surprising, actually, that even that small number does happen. It seems like a lot of pieces of the puzzle have to be in place for it to actually happen.
Yeah, and there's other sort of nuances to it as well. In, you know, crucially in the UK at the moment, if you're an intended parent and you go through a surrogacy journey, you're not actually recognised as the legal parent of your child at birth. There is a sort of post-birth process that has to happen. And actually at the point of birth, even, you know, if you're a surrogate and you say, here's your child, congratulations, you and your spouse, if you have a spouse, will actually be considered the legal parents of that child until that legal process has taken place to enable the transfer of parentage to take place through this sort of parental order system. And the purpose of that order is effectively to extinguish the rights of the surrogate and her spouse, if she has one, and transfer it over to the intended parent. So, you know, there is this odd position where...
A little bit of no man's land.
Yeah,
between the two. That's really interesting. And of course, I have to ask you the question. I guess sometimes things can get tricky. There are probably flashpoints where communications break down. Where are the complications in that process? And, you know, how can it go wrong?
I think one of the key flashpoints really is that surrogacy arrangements in the UK are not legally binding, which means that in any arrangement, there is always a potential risk that the relationship between the surrogate and the intended parents will break down. And for whatever reason, the parties want to renege on the arrangement they've reached, you know, whether it's as extreme as the surrogate saying, I don't want to transfer, you know, parental rights over to you and transfer that parentage, or whether it's the intended parents, you know, for whatever reason, at the hospital door saying, oh, well, actually, I don't want this child anymore. The surrogate is the parent. So, you know, whilst in reality circumstances like that are very rare, there is this fundamental underlying risk that something like that might happen. Mitigating against things like that is really sort of making sure that you've got an open dialogue from the beginning and you really know exactly what it is that you both want to achieve and get out of it, even from, you know, the most mundane things such as if you've got a concern about them eating a particular food or, you know, bits and pieces like that, just to make sure, or, you know, do you want to speak to them a lot during the pregnancy and find out how it's going? Do you want to be left alone? And making sure that everybody is aligned on their wishes to try and ensure that relationship, you know, remains good throughout.
Of course, I hadn't even thought of elements like that, like the involvement during the pregnancy, because diet is a massive issue. I mean, really affects immunizations are an issue, or even decisions to drink caffeine or alcohol. And so I guess they can all be flashpoints.
Yeah, exactly. And if it's not something that you've discussed and actually, you know, you think everything is plain sailing and that you're completely aligned in terms of what you're trying to achieve, and then it turns out that you've got very different views on, you know, I'm actually pregnant at the moment and there's so many things that you're not supposed to eat, but, you know, it's a risk factor. So it's, are you happy with them taking that risk or not taking that risk? And, you know, you're handing control over to them, really. So making sure that that's been discussed beforehand.
And I guess the crucial point is actually the days and weeks after the baby is born. That I suppose that's when, I mean, feelings change. And I suppose that must be a complicated area too.
Yeah, I mean, actually, so when the baby is born, as I mentioned earlier, the intended parents aren't automatically the parents at that point. There's a process that needs to happen. And the process of getting a parental order, ordinarily, it takes about sort of 6 to 12 months to get that to go through fully. And a surrogate mother is not able to consent to the transfer of parentage until a period of at least 6 weeks after birth. So in reality, you know, what happens in most circumstances is a surrogate gives birth, intended parents take the child home with them. But then you have this sort of disconnect between what the law recognises as being the child's parents and who is practically doing things on the ground. And that can, you know, have really serious implications in some circumstances. For example, if the baby needs medical treatment, technically speaking, the person that is able to consent to that medical treatment is not, you know, the parents that are looking after the child on a day-to-day basis. It's the surrogate who is unlikely to want to make those decisions, and it puts everyone in a tricky position. Particularly as well, you know, you get people that go internationally for surrogacies because of, you know, the benefits of the framework, etc. But irrespective of whether you have a domestic or a international surrogacy, when you come home, you are still not recognised as the parent until that process of getting the parental order takes place. So you could have a circumstance in which you've entered into a surrogacy agreement abroad on the condition that there is no ongoing ties between you and the surrogate and they're not going to be involved. And you come home and, you know, your child needs an immunisation and technically you're not the one that's supposed to be consenting to that, or, you know, anything, you know, more extreme than that in a hospital situation.
And of course, the law in the UK applies and supersedes the law where you had, for example, the surrogacy arrangement, wherever that is. So when you're back in the UK, it's UK law. So you have to wait until that process has gone through.
Yeah, in order to be recognised legally as a parent in the UK, you would need to make sure that you go through this process when you get back. So you might have a birth certificate issued, depending on the country that you go to, that says you are the legal parents, parent one, parent two. But notwithstanding that, you still have to come back and go through this process over here to ensure that it's recognised here as well.
Wow, fascinating. Really, really interesting and complicated. It is quite, yeah, quite tricky.
Really, really complicated, and things that you wouldn't... I think the difficulty is because of the way that we are with the law and, you know, how things have moved on since the 1980s, we're essentially in a position where it doesn't reflect what you might think going into these sort of arrangements would be common sense and practical, you know, considerations are just currently missing.
So if you were to give advice to parents who are considering surrogacy, what would you say to them if they're considering surrogacy?
Yeah, so I think the earlier that intended parents obtain legal advice, the better, so that, you know, that they are informed from the outset. And certainly our role as solicitors is sort of largely limited to the post-birth, getting the parental order sorted. But much earlier than that, understanding what it is that you're going to be required to do and getting all of that done before you're, you know, up all hours of the night looking after a child and before these sort of flashpoints arise means that you'll be really knowledgeable and, you know what you're going into. Certainly if you're considering an international surrogacy, you'll need to consider not only getting advice from a surrogacy law specialist, but also an immigration specialist to make sure that, you know, you can return home with your baby and that doesn't become an issue of itself. And I'm sure that there is nobody that enters into a surrogacy arrangement without giving it a considerable amount of thought, probably at the end of a very, you know, a tumultuous long journey of, you know, trying to become a parent. But really do your research and make sure you know what your options are so that you're going into it with open eyes.
Really, really helpful advice there, Jodie. That really brilliant. And thank you so much for helping our listeners navigate that, because it's tricky. It's not a simple process for sure. Mainly, I would say, because of the emotions as well that are potentially involved in it. And that's something the law can't cater for, I guess.
Absolutely.
So, Jodie, just before we let you go, I'd love to ask, you know, it mean about the process. Like when you think about a woman carrying a child for somebody else so that they can have a family when they probably haven't been able to have a family, it's such an altruistic, kind and generous process. And I wonder from your side, is that part of the reason why you focused on surrogacy and what kind of a legal process it is?
Yeah, I mean, I think as family lawyers, we generally are involved in helping people with issues pertaining to the breakdown of their relationships, the breakdown of their marriage, you know, issues relating to children. So actually to be able to have an area of practice in family law, which is very much focused on family formation rather than breakdown, is, you know, it's just wonderful to be able to be a part of that.
Brilliant. Jodie, thanks so much for honestly opening my eyes to the process of surrogacy and thanks for joining us on The Parents Show.
Thank you very much for having me, Lydia.
The Parents Show on Mix 92.6, sponsored by Raiden Solicitors, award-winning specialist family lawyers. See raidensolicitors.co.uk.